Launch this podcast ship, Jen.
I shall. I don't know. I can't remember any of the lines.
Voulez-vous?
I can't think of a noise.
In about 15 minutes, I'm going to say voulez-vous.
You're going to say what?
Voulez-vous.
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 Volavant.
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 Volavant. Like I'll make that kind of noise. Yeah.
Volavant.
Volavant.
Okay.
Just a heads up.
Voulez-vous and volavant, you are listening to Jen and the Film Critic, a Scream Mayhem podcast. My name is Jen Blundell, and with me, as always, is my film critic, Paul Salt. Say hello, Paul Salt.
Voulez-vous.
Voulez-vous. Volavant. Voulez-vous.
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 Tara Molinos.
Tara Molinos.
I'm an English man abroad.
You are.
I don't know how to do anything.
Una cerveza, por favor.
Favor.
Paul, we're talking about films today.
Donde está la chip shop?
le magasin.
Frititas.
De frites.
Ville. Magasin de frites.
Le magasin de frites.
Perfect, flawless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got a degree in that language.
You've got a degree in most languages as well.
In most languages, that's what my degree says. Degree in most languages.
Brackets don't ask.
To be fair, my degree title is just modern languages. That's all of the modern
ones. Don't get much more modern than that.
No.
Whatever that was we were doing.
Whatever that was. Parle-moi du film.
Ah, du film. Du cinéma. Well. It's Valentine's Day, or it would have been when we first planned to record this.
Yay!
Nevertheless, a lot of my structural work here is Valentine's Day related, so let's stick to it. Yay, Valentine's Day!
No one needs to know, it's 5 days later.
Yay! So I have match-made most of my films.
Aww! A concept, a theme, I love it.
Love that.
One gold star.
And we're going to start just the one.
For you.
But there are more, more that might be earned.
Yeah, there is room. There's room for stars to be earned, Paul.
There's always
I want you to bear that in mind for the rest of the recording.
I will, and it becomes very important for one of our films later on. But for now, mm-hmm. A film that's capable of very, very few stars. It's the romantic movie of the season, Argyle.
I don't know if I've even heard of this.
A flicker of recognition danced across Jen's face, but then was immediately surrounded by the swampy gases of doubt.
Yeah, no, I don't know what we're talking about.
No worries.
I'm so romantic.
Yes, this is Ellie Conway, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, uh-huh. is a successful author just finishing up her latest ridiculous spy novel, the sort of framing of which constitutes the beginning of the film. Her life is then turned upside down when a mysterious stranger named, get the Grammarly note out of the way, Aidan Wilde, played by Sam Rockwell, saves her from a team of assassins and reveal that actually her books have been uncannily close to real life. You have seen this horrible trailer.
I have seen this trailer, yes.
Yes, this is a very obnoxious trailer that was around for quite a long time. Yes, they then embark on a sort of, you know, Alfred Hitchcock, couple on the run style thing that eventually escalates and escalates and escalates until finally she discovers who is Agent Argyle. Mm-hmm. Also, she's got a cat with her, but the cat is an Agent Argyle because that would be too fun.
Wouldn't want that.
We're dealing with Matthew Vaughn here.
Okay.
The director of the Kingsman movies.
Ah, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And we're in his sort of alternating quality sort of thing that he's got going on because he made a few films in his early career that I quite enjoyed. He made Kick-Ass, which I was a big fan of. And I remember liking Layer Cake well enough. Felt it was, you know, very heavily sort of steeped in the Guy Ritchie lore of which he was a part because he used to be Guy Ritchie's producer.
Okay.
Nevertheless, he made a few films that I quite enjoyed. Then the Kingsman, the first one. I can't remember what the first one was called. Secret Service or something. Which was fun, minus one somewhat awkward sequence.
Yeah, the end.
The ending, yes. Then he made the second one, which I did not enjoy at all. I really disliked the second one, and it's sort of lean into over-the-top aesthetic and no stakes and just sort of eyebrows-raised awkwardness. That's with Julianne Moore.
Yes! You know what?
And Elton John.
I think... Yes, I enjoyed Elton John in that. I thought Elton John was very fun in that. No, I enjoyed parts of that, and I liked... there's bits of it I liked, but again, there's always a scene.
There's
always one scene where you're just like...
Yes.
No, thank you.
Nevertheless...
Apparently that's from the comics, right? Like, that's...
I don't know.
I think it's a... It's a sort of something that's been ported over from the comics.
I think it's Mark Millar, and he does like that sort of thing. He did write the Kick-Ass novel in the day.
It does feel a bit comic booky at times. Yeah, and you're like, you didn't
sort of
need
this. Edgy, edgelord kind of
very
thing.
Edgelord. Yeah,
Yeah. Anyway, I didn't enjoy Kingsman 2: The Golden Circle.
Yeah,
but then he makes The King's Man, which, in spite of all of its political issues, I enjoyed a great deal.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It was good fun. Mm. And now here we are with Argyle, and we're right back to the Golden Circle territory for me. I've written myself notes to just like one line. And the next line is ideological and aesthetic differences. Okay. That's fair enough. I know exactly what I meant by
okay,
that.
Great.
I have ideological and aesthetic differences with Matthew Vaughan.
Fine. Okay.
The end. No, the man's, you know, he's a conservative. He's done publicity films for the Conservative Party. And there is something of the sort of old school Tory about most of his films.
Interesting. Okay.
There's a fair amount of demonization of the working classes and sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of mentality, no feather bedding kind of rhetoric. Mm. And then aesthetically, he quite likes, and this is something that I'm not that into, really hideous imagery.
Mm.
And you see, I'm not very into that.
I personally love hideous imagery.
Well, you know, I can tell. I can see your decor.
Thank you. I can tell by your face and the way you dress and everything about
you. I say, with my framing involving unmade bed, books I haven't read, DVDs, fireplace, and naked man that I'll get to later. So, he has this fondness for sort of very vulgar colours, awkward framing, very look at me kind of storybook, comic book frame imagery, which just doesn't do it for me. And the powerful ugliness of it reaches its nadir during a ice skating sequence near the end, in which he asked himself, what would make this sequence more embarrassing and off-putting? Oh, what if everyone involved were wearing gas masks that magnified their face so that they have sort of moon faces as they CG skate around this environment? It's just... Oh, it's very unpleasant. It's something I viscerally wanted to look away from the screen to stop enduring. Mm. Meanwhile, the story is meandering and fairly uninteresting. You've got this whole lost identity kind of hidden memories kind of thing going on, which is just so hard to do well and write. And most of the time it just means that every 5 minutes you're throwing all of the investment that you've managed to accumulate out the window and having to buy into a whole new premise. Mm. And the action sequences are not very engaging. And for a romantic comedy, it doesn't really succeed in being very funny or romantic.
Okay.
The sequences in which they have to try and establish chemistry are largely sort of underlined by just the lack of ability to build characters out of either of these two. Which is not in spite of the best efforts of the two lead performers. Bryce Dallas Howard is very charming and affecting as the sort of every woman kind of main character. But Sam Rockwell...
Yeah.
Tends to make everything he's in better.
Yeah.
And really brings it here. There's a sequence of him dancing, which is always the highlight of any film he's
absolutely.
In. He's a marvelously charismatic and charming man, and in spite of how terrible and sort of old fashioned the script is, he still manages to bring a fair amount to the table.
Cool.
So God bless him for that. I think the most telling thing about the film is that there's a cat in it for Out, and it's CG.
Yeah.
It's a CG cat. Yeah. I feel like that's a metaphor for the whole thing. The
saw
cat
that in the trailer.
CG.
Didn't like it.
No. Get a cat. Get a real cat.
Get a real cat.
So I'm afraid it's one star. It actually actively irritated me. And
okay.
I don't... At the end, it's not much of a spoiler to say they do tie it in with the Kingsman universe. And it's just not a universe I'm particularly excited by. Although I was. Only one movie ago, The King's Man, I was excited enough to see more action sequences.
Mm.
You know. Set in this world, which is essentially all you can really ask for a series like this. But likable characters were at the very least the bedrock of the two Kingsman movies I liked. You know, Colin Firth's character in the first one and Ralph Fiennes in the third one
Yeah.
were a good bedrock.
Yeah.
And I think you need that. You know, John Wick is very likable.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to have a bit of charm and charisma going in order for you to buy into the actual premise of the action. And here, in spite of Sam Rockwell, I just wasn't feeling it.
Shame.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Ugh, an annoying film. So perhaps it might learn something if we paired it with something a little more classically romantic. How about The Taste of Things?
The Taste of Things.
The Taste of Things. So this is a new film by Tran Anh Hung. I believe a Vietnamese-born French director. Not that's particularly relevant, but he's made films. The film I've seen before of his is Norwegian Wood, the adaptation of the Murakami film.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen any of his others, but The Scent of Green Papaya that he made in 1993 is meant to be extremely good. I look forward to catching up with that soon. But yes, this film is set in the late 19th century, and it's, how to describe it? It's basically a romance between a cook, played by Benoît Magimel, and the gourmet is Benoît Magimel. The cook is Juliette Binoche, and they kind of work together, and they have a good reputation amongst high society. The character is from a novel, but the actual story is wholly original. Which is interesting. The movie opens with the cooking and preparation and consumption of an omelet.
Ooh. Classic.
Just a classic omelette, which the cooks sort of make together and then share with someone who joins them at the table, and the person who joins them is told to eat it with a spoon. It makes all the difference. And it just beautifully, and as they're doing this, the table is absolutely heaped high with vegetables and various ingredients that are about to become part of the meal. They're about to all cook together. The opening 40 minutes are then committed to the preparation and serving of a single meal.
Wow.
The centerpiece of which is this massive vol-au-vent.
Okay.
And throughout the film,
that's why you
see.
Sick.
That's why. Okay. We've come full circle, folks.
Okay, cool.
And throughout the film, we see the tender art of cooking, gently pressing a veal rib joint into the pan in order to sear it, tossing vegetables in a sizzling pan, delicate sugar work, caviar nudged into oyster shells. These, you know, just little moments, little details of the preparation of food as a sort of expression of an art, but also a sort of very deep affection. The most tenderness we see is when meals are prepared for a loved one between the two of them. And you get these really esoteric moments, such as our gourmand? What did I just say?
Gourmet and gourmand are two different things, and I get them the wrong way around all the time. I think a gourmet is someone who enjoys food but doesn't overdo it, and a gourmand is a little piggy. It could be the other way around.
Well, gourmet is what I'm after. Gourmet is what I'm after. So he is dipping the feet of a chicken into boiling water so that he can very carefully peel the skin from it for his own reasons. And sometimes the close-up work just feels scientific. Yeah. Like the way we get so close to the ingredients to see sort of what is being done, but never without... It never loses the warmth, the warmth of the act. And the textures of the little kitchen become so important. It's the late 19th century, so there's no plastic to be seen. Ingredients arrive from pewter and porcelain. It's cooked in tin and iron. And most importantly, it's then prepared on wood. And the wooden surfaces the food is prepared and eaten from are these gorgeous sort of lived-in wooden tables that bespeak generations of sort of culinary history and meals shared together. And then adding to all this, you have the light. Director Tran Anh Hung and cinematographer Jonathan Rieckborg bathe the frame in this golden light that could easily feel overly sentimental if not paired with this really pragmatic but sincere approach to the framing that makes the whole thing feel just incredibly natural and just as if you've just walked into a kitchen at just the right time, sort of between day and night, the sort of sun setting. Yeah. And the garden sits outside, and yeah, the sound is so deeply important because the sizzling, chopping sound of skin underhand is all there, but equally important is the French countryside just outside the always open door, because most of the film is set during the summer, so you have the door open and the sort of birds chirping and bugs kind of humming away out there, and the sound is used very cleverly to indicate the passage of time, the idea that cooking this amount of food takes time and effort. Which they're both willing to do. But describing the food sequences feels like fixating on the sort of action scenes in a film, because all of this is actually serving a purpose.
Okay.
It's not just a bunch of incredibly gorgeous sequences of food being prepared. It's a very tender portrayal of the act of love through food. Because we have Juliette Binoche and Benoît Magimel, who apparently were partners for about 10 years in real life, having a daughter together before breaking up, and then apparently not really communicating with each other for the, you know, decades leading up to this film.
Wow.
And perhaps that helps to account for the very deep sense of melancholy that they share in their chemistry. The sort of longing between them is really palpable, because they have this kind of relationship where they never have fully happened.
Okay.
They've sort of been with each other, but never in a sort of official capacity.
Yeah.
And are perhaps making that decision a little too late in the day. But Binoche is, of course, just wonderful as the saintly and kind of ephemeral Eugenie. But I must say, my heart was just absolutely stolen in this film by Magimel as Dodin. Such a gentle and soulful performance. You know, every moment you spend with him is just a pleasure, right from his first friendly inclusion of the young girl at his breakfast table. It reminds me of the blue kaftan, which we talked about last year. The Moroccan one, where sort of the work of being dressmakers kind of becomes this expression of affection and love and warmth and, you know, the really deep sort of tenderness within these characters who feel, for whatever reason, like they can't necessarily be who they want to be with each other. And yet are able to express everything they need to through their craft. This film has that. And yeah, I haven't been able to stop thinking about it since seeing it. It's 5 stars. I just can't wait to get back into this world and just dream of all these wonderful meals again.
That sounds lovely. Yeah.
The original French title, incidentally, is Pot-au-feu. And of course, Pot-au-feu.
Yeah, nailed it. You speak French now.
you're the worst. You're the worst person I know. That's exactly what I would talk about when I talk about you discouraging me.
How many French pronunciations of pain in the patella.
Oh, shit.
If you want, it's more like a th rather than a fu. Yeah, perfect.
Excellent. Well, the reason
I'm doubting whether the T is pronounced or whether it's one of those French... Oh, French.
I'm pretty sure he was pronouncing the pot.
The tea, yeah.
The tea.
And it's kind of stew?
Yes, it's just a very plain beef and vegetable stew. And the reason for it is that he goes to this prince's banquet that's been laid out for him, where they are served food over the course of 8 hours.
Yeah.
And he decides that he's going to repay the gesture by serving just an incredibly humble French meal.
Okay.
That as he says, has nourished families for generations. And it's all about that. It's all about the best meals being the sort of simplest ones, but done carefully, you know, and with talent. And it's just, lovely.
Real food. Lovely. Yeah, that sounds great. I'd love to watch that.
It's so good. I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah. It's not in French, though, is it?
No, some of it is. To be honest, there's very little dialogue. Well, there were these lovely long dialogue sequences where they take strolls together across the sort of fields and... Oh, they take an evening meal by the sort of lake, the sort of very, marshy, kind of marshy kind of lake. They have a table set up there and take a late evening meal, but it's just wonderful.
Yeah, that sounds idyllic.
Yeah, it really is. It's what I think in that same way. You know, I think it's what people picture when you talk about a French film.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm wondering what part of France it's set in or it's meant to be set in, because I imagine it's just going to make me even more like, I've been there, and even I idealize France.
Yeah.
Idealize France and how like, you're just like, it's perfect. It's just full of beautiful food and beautiful houses and beautiful countryside and beautiful xenophobia. Just like the UK.
It is actually.
Just like the UK, but with better food and weather.
I mean, the food isn't even that dissimilar in terms of its makeup. But then there's all this skill and sort of, because it is, you know, beef and vegetables.
It's a French hot pot, but knowing not to, like, I love an overcooked carrot, but
Oh, God, yeah, don't.
But
don't.
When you just take carrots and boil them in water and for 20 minutes, that and is, you're like, here you go. Yeah.
No, that's true. We did go a dark way.
We did.
They're very much like our shadow selves.
Our shadow
selves. No, we're their shadow selves.
Yeah. In this universe, no one came to us when we were 8 years old and taught us how to cook a carrot.
Oh, God. It's fundamental skills, people.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we should continue with our Valentine's Day special.
Oh, okay.
Because what about every woman's natural love for Dakota Johnson?
Chocolate Johnson.
But yes, the potentially unhealthy love that many people feel for Dakota Johnson that might lure them into Madam Web. Here we go. Sony Pictures limps on with its Spider-Man-less Spider-Man franchise, featuring Venom, Morbius, and now Madam Web. The film focuses on Cassandra Webb, played by Dakota Johnson, as she finds herself capable of seeing into the immediate future. And this sets her onto a collision course with three teen girls who seem to be the target of the villainous Ezekiel Sims, played by Tahar Rahim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a moment, or for moments, there are stretches where you feel like this is what you hope for. When you go to all these forgettable action movies and superhero movies, you just hope for something this bizarre and inept and silly that keeps finding new ways to surprise you. And for a long stretch, you are actually carried along with it.
Okay.
Because it starts straight away, right from the prologue sequence set in the Amazon. And incidentally, the legendary line, "He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died," doesn't appear in the movie.
Oh, okay. All right.
Shame. But shame. That was invented in the marketing. But nevertheless, there's plenty of inexplicable, terrible dialogue to keep you going. But the movie starts in the Amazon with Kerry Bish as Cassie's mother. And she's delivering lines in this stilted way, but also racing as if she's been told that the camera's low on battery. And the framing is just bananas and incredibly funny. It changes angle every couple of seconds. Even in dialogue sequences.
Okay.
So it just immediately gets you in. And then Dakota Johnson appears.
Okay.
Now, I love Dakota Johnson.
Yeah.
I really enjoy her presence. She has this incredibly awkward, slightly unsettling energy, you know, kind of sleepy unnaturalness that works really great in films like Suspiria or The Lost Daughter, Bad Times at El Royale, A Bigger Splash. Even the first 50 Shades of Grey movie, I think it kind of gives her a slight, oh, is there something sinister about her, actually? But then obviously James hadn't written that.
No.
But she is very miscast here, which is wonderful. It is wonderful because the character is surly and awkward and she's perfect for that, but then it just goes so far to the point where it's just like nobody would write this. Nobody would write this moment. This is just a Johnson original. And it's fun to have a hero who has no physical strength or speed or offensive powers.
Okay.
But they struggle to use her foresight in interesting ways.
Right.
You know, the movie that has to come to mind is Next, the Nicolas Cage film 2007. That movie is ridiculous and fairly poor, but finds many more exciting ways to utilize the powers of foresight in an action sequence than this film does. Okay. This film does it about a dozen times and mostly in the first act. And it's very obvious in how it does it. You know, you've got like the final destination moment. Something very memorable will happen, like a balloon pops, and you'll be like, okay, this is the beginning of a loop. We're going to see this several times. Sure. And it's very predictable. There's one standout sequence of this where she's on a train and the bad guy's about to attack. And it loops a whole bunch of times and kind of overwhelms her. And there's a good sense of her reality slipping away from her as she sort of starts seeing the big picture. Which ultimately is where you need to go, because anyone who's seen like the Spider-Man animated series will know that Madam Web kind of became this sort of ephemeral, I see everything kind of, so I can't relate to any immediate problems you might be having kind of thing. You know, like she becomes superhuman in that sense and loses herself, which is just very amusing to picture Dakota Johnson doing.
Yes.
I need help. I'm turning into a giant spider. Oh, yeah, whatever. Good luck. Good luck with that.
Did you know in 100 years this guy they're gonna will be have blue?
They're gonna have a cure for that in like 100 years. Oh, but that doesn't help you. Like, just she's gonna be so fey with the whole thing, and I love that. I love that for her. But yeah, just some all-time line reads in this. She finds beef jerky for the girls that she's inexplicably kidnapped to eat. And
wait, she's kidnapped the girls to eat?
She's kidnapped them to eat, but she's given them beef jerky to fatten them up first. Mm. And one of them's like, I don't like beef jerky. And she says, oh, well, I hope you're good at catching squirrels. It's just
what
an odd line delivered strangely. Later on, she tells them, don't do anything dumb. Don't do dumb things.
Okay.
Such emphasis, such dramatas. But
wow,
again, just
script,
this,
huh?
Just this sleepy monotone that which combined with a terrible script, really does create something a little bit special. But it is boring in places.
Okay,
there's enough camp to it that becomes quite enjoyable, but there are long stretches where you just don't get anything from the audience. And I've seen it with a fairly full crowd, and it just didn't play very well. You know, nevertheless, I have seen some people purporting that it has gone down extremely well with their crowds. And I saw a tweet purporting to be news that suggested some teens had been expelled from a screening for whispering the film's tagline, her web connects them all, into an extensive network of cans connected by strings. Which is a fabulously surreal gag that is all the funnier because of how ridiculous that tagline is.
Her web connects them all.
Because web you'll see these, all the posters have her, all the posters have her looking like vaguely smug on them with the line, her web connects them all just beneath. And it's like, yeah, my web, the web I made.
The web I made connects you all.
It connects you all.
Eat like, it, where, suckers.
How did you make that web? Where's this web coming from? But yeah, I mean, the most commonly circulated promotional image is of Dakota Johnson looking perplexed at a web. And so it's just, it's so on the nose, you know, what could it mean?
What could it
where
mean?
Where does this web lead?
What could web you mean know? In this circumstance?
As somebody else on Twitter pointed out, early on in the movie, it foreshadows the importance of a giant red neon S. And then at the end of the movie, they get into a fight in a factory where there's a Pepsi-Cola logo on the roof with big glowing letters, including an S. And it shows the S again in several sequences. And Dakota Johnson notices the S and is really attentive at the S. And then the bad guy gets kicked off the roof and is crushed by a big P.
That's good.
So good.
That's really good.
It's very funny.
It's very
now,
funny.
Look, to be fair to the filmmakers, this does reek of studio interference. It has all the hallmarks of something that was massively and clumsily reworked in post-production, especially the extensive use of ADR, the additional dialogue recording, especially with the film's villain, who seems to have had almost all of his dialogue replaced.
Oh,
and
no.
It's very obvious when it cuts between him in a sound booth and him on set.
Right.
Like, there have been some bad examples of this before, but this is horrifically obvious. Mm. And they are so clumsy in working around it that they often dub him whenever his mouth is not on screen. So if he just turns away for a moment, they'll sneak a quick line of exposition in. But what's bizarre is it's often repeating things that we already know. So test audiences must have said, oh, it's confusing, or something like that, because they've really spell out everything. God, which also may have been the fact that we do see the three women, one of whom is Sydney Sweeney, inexplicably, in their spider suits, which might have been a last minute decision to sort of put some spider people in the movie because our hero doesn't have that. So,
no.
But the effect is just deliriously amusing. The absurdity of having your villain mostly speak off screen. It is an absurd film, but not necessarily in a camp way, but it... For a great length of the runtime, it is good fun. So I think it's 2 stars, but it's a recommendation kind of to have a look at this and just see just the wheels absolutely fall off this thing in a sort of Schadenfreude style way. And ultimately, it's been worthwhile just for Dakota Johnson's press tour promoting the film. She's been marvelous. Yeah, she was asked if she could name the 3 Tom Holland Spider-Man films, and she said... Yeah, yes I can. The first one is Spider-Man, Here He Comes. Then Spider-Man, and he's back. and the third one is the goblet of Spider-Man. Harry Spider-Man and the Goblet of Man. That is word for word because I've watched it like 7 times.
That's really good.
So good. She was asked, have you seen the film? And she said, no, I haven't, but I should. I will watch it. Someday.
Wow.
She's great. Someone on Twitter was suggesting we should just not tell her that. Yes. I really hope that Dakota Johnson just continues this press tour like those Japanese soldiers who kept fighting World War II.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Just keep having her promote this movie for years.
For years. She's doing a great job of it.
She's doing so good.
No one distract her with a new script. This is her job now.
This is her job. But you know, I guess all the Dakota Johnson gals are just going to have to learn the harsh lesson that sometimes your girl crush can turn toxic. Especially if that girl crush is on a franchise that is yet to yield a second good film. It's Mean Girls!
Aha! Mean Girls the musical. Mean Girls the secret musical.
My name is Regina George. Yes, the secret
musical.
I'm here to say, I am a mean girl in a massive way. Breakdown. We're from the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a dark and scary place. Incidentally, Madame Web was set in 2003 and has these really weird reminders. Like, suddenly she'll just park in front of a massive Beyonce sign and it's like that era of Beyonce.
Wow, okay. Yeah.
Or, brilliantly, she'll be fighting a guy who can infect people with his toxic poisons. What's that on the radio? Hit me, baby, one more time.
Oh, I see. Okay. I thought you were going to talk about the, like, anthrax scare. Remember when the people...
Oh, yeah!
People afraid of posting... People being posted,
you know,
anthrax.
This movie doesn't get into the war on terror at all, and it's
no,
to its detriment.
That sucks.
And neither does Mean Girls, in spite of... Oh, being a remake of a movie that came out in about 2003, I think.
Oh, yeah.
There's a connection. Bad Could then. Have done that instead of this weird Valentine's Day thing. Anyway, Katie Heron, Angerie Rice in this one, is a teenage girl who transfers from homeschooling in Kenya to a typical American school, where she falls in with two eccentric outsiders, Janice and Damien, that's Aliai Carvalho and Jaquiel Spivey, who warn her about the various cliques of the school, including the villainous and toxic Plastics, who are Karen, played by Avantika, Gretchen, BB Wood, and their leader, Regina George, Renee Rapp. But after an altercation with the Plastics, you know this. You know exactly.
I know exactly what you're talking
what this
about.
This is happening here. You know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And also,
we all know. And if you don't know, you're a loser. Get out of town. Go watch Mean Girls.
Get in. Get into the car. We're going to go see Mean Girls.
Yeah.
Also, it's a musical. So I wonder how fun it is for fans of musical theatre, like diehard fans of musical theatre, like have, you know, real, like hardcore. You know, have done the double bill of Phantom at the Opera and the other one, whatever it's called. Nobody knows because it's a weird thing to do.
Love Never Dies?
That's the one.
The sequel.
Yeah, sequel.
That I have the soundtrack to.
That you have the soundtrack to and that tattoo of. And
yeah, it's not good.
No.
Some of the songs are. Most of it's bad.
I feel like, isn't that the point of Andrew Lloyd Webber in general?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a Wally. He's out there with Paul Bettany, where I try not to think about him in real life. But he's written so many musicals that I like.
Yeah.
I'm like, I do love this. And at the same time, I can see that it's kind of rubbish. But I also do love it. Like, I'm very fond of Starlight Express.
Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ Superstar was on TV the other day.
Answer me yes. I don't want you to go. We're trains. We're just all trains singing to each other.
Yeah, we're just all trains.
We're all trains. We're all trains.
It's a really good song, actually. But I wonder how people who are super into musicals feel about the influx recently of big budget musicals all based on movies. Because it's a big thing, and of course, more interesting work is out there. But I can't imagine people who take this very seriously are too thrilled by Back to the Future the musical and Mrs. Doubtfire and Frozen and Stranger Things and Groundhog Day. You know, good though some of these are, it's surely a little tedious to just constantly have movies encroach on this space.
I can tell you that I personally, I really enjoyed music. I loved musicals a lot as a teenager in particular, I'd say.
Sure.
Not so hardcore, like, you know, there's always a bigger fan out there. Mm. But, I listened to a lot of musical soundtracks and like going to see them.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. not a fan.
Some
of the older ones like Beauty and the Beast that I feel has been around for decades.
I mean, if it's based on a musical, that's probably like The Lion King, you know. Yeah. If there are actual songs. That's true. Then I imagine that helps. But yeah, it's a very odd thing.
Even then, I went to see the Prince of Egypt musical, and I love the Prince of Egypt film.
Oh, yeah.
It is not a musical. It's a film that I love very much because I went to a Christian primary school.
Oh, yeah.
No, it is a musical. It does have great songs in it. What am I talking about?
Oh, God.
It's got an amazing soundtrack. But it didn't. It just feels like a cash grab at a certain point. And well, they did, you know, the cast and crew and everyone did a really good, they did their best, but you just sort of sat there watching it being like, yeah, you just tried to make money. This is just pure, which I get, it's a business, but still.
Yeah.
Well,
we're getting very close back to our original thing here, but yeah.
Okay.
I imagine it's similar to movies.
Yeah.
In a sense, the big stuff is based on, you know, not original IPs or sequels to existing things like, you know, I keep calling it Love Lies Bleeding, I want to call it. I've got it
yes,
on the brain.
Yes, it is. Yes, Love Lies Bleeding. Love Never Dies.
I'm definitely going to book tickets now. Yeah. But yeah, I keep it's probably like that. And then in the fringes, the smallest theatres, you know, off the West End or, you know, just in other venues in the West End, you will find the more interesting stuff. You will find the more independent stuff, the new ideas, the underrepresented voices sort of crying out in song kind of thing. It's still out there. There's probably great musical theatre made every year, you know, in the same way that there's great movies made every year, and it's just about what you see.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me that musical theatre, mainstream, big-budget musical theatre, craves the pop culture pull of the cinema these days. You know, in the early days of the cinema, it was the other way around, because the cinema absolutely coveted the legitimacy of theatre. That's what they wanted. They wanted to be taken seriously, and so they would adapt plays or... You know, it's interesting that doesn't really, how that reflects on sort of how the two things have done that is interesting because, you know, in the 30s, 40s, it was, we'll get George Bernard Shaw to write our movie. Brilliant. 90 years later on, we'll get Spider-Man to appear in, in act three.
Yeah.
But anyway, Mean Girls became a musical in 2017 under the auspices of Tina Fey, who did the book whilst Neil Benjamin wrote the songs. The songs are all right. Some of them are very memorable, but in general, they hit a lot less hard than a film that we'll be talking about shortly. And the script is Mean Girls. So there's very little adaptation that's been done, really. There's no elaboration, you know, and that's the issue, really, because the film doesn't get out from under the hefty legacy of the original film.
Oh, yeah.
But this isn't... The problem is it's not really an attempt to, because... The play wasn't, you know, production wasn't. And this is the awkward thing, because this is exactly what you'd expect from seeing this at the theatre. A combination of like a repertory screening of the film, or possibly perhaps like a drag performance of it, you know, in terms of taking material the audience is familiar with and performing it in a new way that will then, you know, elicit a different response that you then infuse with musical numbers. You know, everybody will cheer when the actor says, "You go Glen Coco." And we'll be charmed by how the music recreates the subtext of the film, maybe taking a background character and having them sing the bit that, you know, everybody knows them for. The unique device of musical theatre doing the work of the unique device of cinema. You know, overt rather than subtext. The problem with translating that back into a movie, you remove the live aspect, you remove the performative aspect, and you're just watching something that feels an awful lot like Mean Girls interrupted with musical numbers.
You're like,
so
why have all the characters changed, but they're still the same?
Yeah.
And now there's music.
Hang on, I've seen this scene better in this medium before, so why am I watching it again? But maybe diehard fans of the original will find this to be a fun addendum to the classic original, but it doesn't serve as a successful update or anything that will stand on its own feet. You know, and apart from anything else, the songs throw the pacing of the film way off.
Sure.
The film is a full 20 minutes longer than the original. Originally, it was like 2.5 hours. They had to cut some numbers. And the anti-plastic scheme doesn't kick in until a long time in.
Okay.
You know, the actual meat of the movie doesn't start until quite a long way in. And the potential, I suppose, is to try and reflect the issues that teenage girls face now, you know, 20 years later from the original film.
Oh, Lord. 20 years later.
Yep, there you go. Social media, advanced phone technology, you know. And the answer to that is that when something embarrassing happens, people just get all their phones out to film it.
Yeah.
And those Vox Populi moments from the original film, you know, Regina George punched me in the face once. It was awesome. Are now TikToks that the kids are doing.
Okay.
And that's it. This is no eighth grade.
Yeah.
So you're in the very awkward position of comparing performers to their counterparts, and only a few do so in any way favorably.
That's tough.
I like Renee Rapp as Regina. I think she's from the original production. She's got the energy, the arrogance, and the hint of self-aware camp that makes that character so fun when she was, you know, done by Rachel McAdams. Cravalho, excuse me for the name, is very good and really finds a deep well of anger and hurt within Janice that was perhaps only hinted at in the original. So that's a bit of an escalation there. And I think that's it. Everyone else is just a shadow of the original characters, because this movie is just a shadow of the original film. It's quite frustrating, I think. The original film had this effortless humor that felt very spontaneous. Like, it felt free.
Yeah.
Like, at any moment, anyone could just say and do anything and it could be realized. And it was just, you know, some very creative and funny people just sort of going off the rails. This film is so locked into the rigid template of its source material that it just comes off as soulless. So, yeah. And like you said, it just, you know, feels like money grabbing. So it's 2 stars.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, when I heard they were doing a Mean Girls, I was like, oh, interesting. And then I heard it was a musical. I'm like, oh, interesting. I didn't realize they were essentially doing the same film again.
I know.
And when I found out that, I was, like, amazed. I thought they were doing a sequel of some sort.
Yeah. No, honestly, even Mean Girls 2 or Bratz are bigger departures from the Mean Girls formula than this. It's ridiculous.
Wow. Interesting. Oh, well. Never mind.
You know what? After that, I'm sick of romantic love.
Yeah, me too.
How about brotherly love?
Oh, yay.
Yay. The Iron Claw.
The Iron Claw. Punch, 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 kick, punch.
Punch, punch.
No kicking.
Well, no kicking, because it's a wrestle movie.
Oh, sorry. Wrestle, wrestle, wrestle. Wrestle, wrestle, wrestle. Eye gouge. Wrestle, wrestle, wrestle.
This is the story of the Von Erichs.
Uh-huh.
A somewhat tragic, very tragic wrestling family. The real story of which I won't reveal here, because it was something I went in not knowing very much about and was very surprised by. But it's basically, yes, a good, how long are we dealing with here? About 10 years of their lives? Sort of their heyday and then decline is what the film sort of covers. Are you looking into the Von Erichs?
No, I will.
Okay.
I'm so fat. I'm staring down. I was just staring down at this little toy bat.
Look, I'm very fond of that toy bat that looks like Batty from Fern Gully.
Yeah.
Voiced by Robin Williams.
It's called Mildred.
I like Mildred. Mildred's all right.
Cute, huh? So that's what I was staring at slightly blankly.
No, like, continue to do that, please. It's good for me.
I'll stare at you blankly instead. Don't worry about it.
Thank you. Zac Efron plays Kevin Von Erich, who's joined by his brothers, played by Jeremy Allen White and Harris Dickinson. And they are sort of under the auspices of their father, played by Michael J. Harney. Is that him? No, I don't know if that is him. Sorry. No, excuse me. They are under the auspices of their father, played by Holt McCallany.
Wow, what a name.
Yeah, it's a good name. He's a good guy. He's been in loads of stuff. A lot of really good stuff with David Fincher. Yeah. And this is the story. This is their story. And it's sold by A24 as a sort of, I think, inspirational sports movie where there's obviously some form of tragedy going on, but that ultimately, you know, a profound story about how family can overcome setbacks and kick ass together, you know, and they'll come back and unite and beat and win the day. So it goes without saying I didn't know much about the real Von Erich family, because if I did, I would have expected something different, because this is a tense and deeply disturbing psychological thriller about how toxicity can absolutely corrupt a family from the inside out, and how love can end up becoming a prison, but also potentially a means of liberation. It's directed by Sean Durkin, who directed Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, the sort of cult movie, and The Nest, the sort of Jude Law film.
Oh, yes, I liked that.
Yes, so what he specialises in are films about characters who are trapped within certain unhealthy situations by whatever motivations, but often from sort of the need to impress other people is something that seems to gravitate with him. And I think that's what sort of bubbles up in The Iron Claw, because all of the brothers are sort of competing and trying to impress this sort of patriarch who very openly keeps a scoreboard of which son he loves best in any given moment, and forces them to sort of compete with each other. And it's really quite brutal, and it has that unique aesthetic that plays into the sort of A24 70s fetishization, because you know, A24 is all about the sort of 1970s golden Hollywood era kind of thing, but this feels uniquely inventive and exciting. There's something very vibrant about Durkin's camera here, which makes it much more interesting to watch than, say, oh, what was that recent one, with Nicolas Cage, Dream Scenario, that had a much more conventional sort of look to it in the A24 mold. But yeah, this yields a sort of fascinating insight into the world at that time, the sort of world of wrestling, seemingly before it became really big. I mean, there's still international shows, there's still a sort of national league, but you get the sense that this is growing out of the sort of local wrestling scene, sort of, you know, for a weekday night activity into a sort of big blockbuster phenomenon.
Are we talking like
professional wrestling?
Grecian professional wrestling, or like, like, but like the what, like the show wrestling, or like,
so that is professional wrestling is what you're thinking about. It is professional wrestling means Hulk
WWE.
Hogan, yeah, WWE,
yes.
All of that. So that's what we're dealing with. It's camp,
interesting.
You know, it's very performative, but you know, very much like Darren Aronofsky's The Wrestler, it is all about sort of the real emotional and physical state. This takes on people. And I think it's absolutely held up by not only its incredible direction, but also brilliant performances from Zac Efron, Jeremy Allen White, who's definitely one to watch, and Harris Dickinson, who just disappears into the role. I didn't even recognize him until the end credits. You've also got Lily James in there offering a really lovely sort of character as well. Holt. Oh, what was his name?
Holt McCallany.
And Holt McCallany is just effortless as the sort of horrific father figure. He's so natural in how he sort of grinds this family down, and yet unawarely, you know, just believes he's just being a dad. You know, and
that's
it's just
the worst.
Yeah, it's if a movie that we're going to be talking about shortly just doesn't takes a far too sentimental view of its central character, that's not The Iron Claw. This is a warts and all story that really took me by surprise.
Interesting.
I've given it 4 stars here. I'm wondering if it deserves 5. I think it does. I think it's 5.
Okay. Back in the 70s, was professional wrestling as performative as it is? I'm wondering at what point, you know, does it, you know, who starts, how, I don't know much about the history of it. You know what? I have a friend who loves professional wrestling. I'll go ask them.
Ooh, who's your friend?
Wouldn't you like to know?
Oh no! Have you got a closeted wrestling fan in your life?
It's someone I went to uni with. Her boyfriend are both mad into wrestling.
Oh, I love that. I have so many friends who are mad into wrestling. Sean and Ellen both do sort of wrestling events. And Sean you know, Sean from Baby Beard Media actually does like wrestling announcing and has
cool.
Yeah. It's a really fun world, and Jack was really into it, so I got to experience some of it that way, and it seems like high camp in a way that's very fun. But
yeah, you can really get invested in it.
Oh, absolutely. But you know what? I'm sick of brotherly love.
Yeah, me too.
How about sisterly love?
Yay, much better.
Yay, it's the color purple.
Ah, wait, what?
Yep, another secret musical.
What?
What? The color purple has been remade as a musical, damn it. Yes.
It's not April yet, Paul.
This has happened.
Okay.
It's an adaptation of the 2005 musical of the 1982 novel by Alice Walker, previously adapted by Steven Spielberg, of course, who returns here as producer.
Okay.
Music by Brenda Russell, Ali Willis, and Stephen Bray. Lyrics by those three. Book, Marsha Norman. So that's the adaptation work that we're seeing here. By director Blitz Bazawuli. Yeah. or Blitz the Ambassador, a Ghanaian filmmaker.
What a name.
Yeah, what a name. And what a, yeah, what a film he's made, because what a made they've all, a movie they've all made, because yes, it's basically, you know, the story of The Color Purple. We are in the sort of Georgia in the early 20th century, mm-hmm. and we are following the sort of lives and misfortunes of two sisters as they are kind of brought apart by various men in their life, and then end up living very different lives apart from each other. We mostly follow Celie, played by Fantasia mm-hmm. Barrino, as she sort of experiences domestic abuse and various other sort of setbacks in the Deep South. So, yeah, I think it's a bleak story and not one that's entirely unfamiliar, although arguably, you know, some of these narratives have come about subsequently to, you know, the novel as it was. But this is, it's still, to some extent, you know, people will say, oh, these are black stories that people are familiar with, stories of, you know, kind of oppression and violence and, you know, eventually a lot of the discrimination and hardship they experience is at the hands of men. So it's a very misogynist kind of system they endure. Racial sort of discrimination rears its ugly head sort of later in the story in order to potentially contextualize all of this.
Sure. You know,
all of what they're experiencing here. Fantasia Barrino as Celie is absolutely incredible. She's, you know, fantastic in both the acting and singing sequences. Tariqi P. Henson plays Shug Avery, a sort of powerful figure who arrives partway into the narrative in order to really challenge a lot of Celie's kind of self-belief issues. And I don't know how overt the queer implications were in previous versions, but it's very, you know, explicit here, which is quite quite fun and quite enjoyable. A real sort of liberating moment there in a very bleak narrative, which this movie is made of. Like, constantly you have moments of joy and laughter that sort of elevate it above the sort of very severe nature of the story. And I do wonder, I wonder the extent to which this is going to reach out to the audiences they want to reach out to, because at this stage, I wonder if black audiences do just want to keep revisiting these narratives, or if this is largely a sort of, you know, offering white audiences the narratives that they expect black audiences to tell, which is something we're definitely going to get into with the next film. Also, Daniel Brooks as Sophia is also just absolutely fantastic. She's basically like the mirror version of Celie, who comes along and sort of, you know, has all of the confidence and brash and, you know, sort of get it done spirit that she lacks. And so she gets to sort of chart her own progress against her and sort of see what happens to them both. Blitz Bazawuli's direction feels big. Like, the musical sequences feel titanic and immense when they land. And it's a beautiful sort of impression of the place, of Georgia at the time. You get a really diverse sense of the landscape, you know, the sort of dark marshlands, but the sort of bright and beautiful sort of cotton fields and the willows and all of this. It's a beautiful sort of place. And, you know, they end up setting up a juke, I think they call it, a sort of dancing bar.
What's that? Oh, okay.
I assume the derivative of jukebox. But they set up a juke like on the river, which is like this floating bar, which is just a wonderfully sort of a wonderful place, which of course, you know, the terrible men
of
object to. Speaking of terrible men, Coleman Domingo as Mr., you know, is just terrifying. Coleman Domingo is really an up-and-coming man, although he is at risk of getting typecast because he was at the BAFTAs, and I can no longer see him without thinking of him as like an early 19th century kind of guy. He's got the mustache, and he just has the early 20th century, I should say, because he's also recently played Rustin in a movie that I haven't seen because it went straight to Netflix. Okay. We'll catch up on Rustin at some point. But yeah, he's also in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, so he's a bit of a risk of being an old-fashioned sort of guy. But no, he's wonderful in this movie.
Cool.
Yeah, it's an extremely good film. It's a very interesting and exciting sort of reinterpretation of this material, potentially to reinvigorate it and make it vibrant again. But yeah, I wonder the extent to which people are ready for new narratives around sort of the black history of the United States.
Fair enough.
Like Ruskin.
I'm Ruskin, that you haven't seen.
That I haven't seen because it went straight to Netflix. Unfortunately, cinemas are still massively discriminatory places that only reward movies that are willing to cater for white folk.
Yeah.
Damn it.
I blame black people for not going to the cinema more.
Damn it.
That's my takeaway.
I feel like I've done a massive disservice for Color Purple, because anyone who does go to see it is going to have this massively empowering experience of it.
Oh, good.
But I do wonder at this stage.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm part of that wondering. Oh, sorry.
How many stars are you giving it?
Oh, I'll give it 4 stars. I'm sick of sisterly love. Let's go back to brotherly love.
Yeah. Oh, great. Much better.
In a slightly less specific sense, a sort of racial brotherly sense, because we're talking about American fiction.
Mm.
So, yeah, people who have sort of seen the trailers will think the premise of this film is that Jeffrey Wright plays a author who is tired of the sort of black fiction that is being celebrated by the largely white kind of publishing, you know, what do you call it, industry.
Yes.
Namely that it has to have, he encounters an author called Sintara, who has published a best-selling novel called Weeze Lives in the Ghetto. Which basically just completely panders, you know, and has black stereotypes all the way through.
Yeah.
Is essentially the idea. And he's sick of this. He's sick of not being able to publish his own work, which is often very historically driven sort of reworkings of, you know, classic myths, you know, kind of things in a very personal sense, which, you know, very sort of high concept intelligentsia kind of things.
Yeah.
And he feels that, you know, with mounting kind of pressures on his own life and lack of recognition, he then adopts the pseudonym of Stag R. Lee and starts writing this absurdly over the top sort of book, which is initially called My Pathology, spelled P-A-F-O-L-O.
Wow. Okay.
But he eventually renames it just as a single word expletive. Just in a desperate attempt to try and provoke what he perceives as being an incredibly ignorant sort of ruling body of publishers to finally take action against him and actually sort of say, no, you've gone too far. But unfortunately, it never does. So it has this Kafka-esque kind of surrealness. Or if not Kafka-esque, who wrote Confederacy of Dunces?
Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Andrew Lloyd Webber.
It's musical. Tool, did you not realise?
John Kennedy Tool. It has that kind of vibe to it, of just sort of, you know, escalating kind of silliness that breaks apart the premise it's sort of within. Because it's quite a self-aware film in those sequences. But here's the thing. That's the movie you think you're getting if you see the trailers. But actually, it's a surprisingly small part of the narrative. As Jeffrey Wright explains it, it's mainly about a man who is forced to become the head of his family. His elder sister, who is the sort of big responsible one, dies. And suddenly he has to contend with a mother with Alzheimer's, an estranged brother, played by, just a moment, Sterling K. Brown, who's rather excellent. And yeah, he's having to now try and rope these various elements together, including a housekeeper who has aspirations of her own. And he's massively overwhelmed because he's never had to take on this kind of responsibility before, and he's always been a bit of an outsider to his family. So what we're and that takes up the vast majority of the runtime, and is potentially a bit more rote, you know, a bit more familiar. The sort of, you know, sickness in the family narrative. It's a bit melodramery potentially,
sure,
at least to me. But I mean, potentially that's just the point, because the whole point here is this. Is the stories that they want to tell versus the stories they are allowed to tell. And the idea is, this is the movie we wanted to make, but this is the movie you paid to see. And so it's very self-aware about the fact that you came to see the sort of thing that they're deconstructing. It's very funny for us. It's continually relevant in terms of what stories are actually allowed to be made. And every sector can relate to this. Like, I still know it within film criticism, you know, if you're a young black film critic trying to get work, you're far better trying to approach publications and offer reviews of sort of black stories, because, you know, they want to have people, you know,
they want an authentic voice.
They want an authentic voice to review these movies.
Yes. Someone who can say whatever because they have the right whatever, the right matching quality.
Yes, exactly. So. You know, and it's not along the lines of interest, but along the lines of sort of personality instead, or, you know, along the lines of sort of personal descriptor instead, which is, you know, basically you end up, with people who are only allowed to tell certain stories being reviewed by people who are only allowed to review certain kinds of movies, and it's a terrible sort of feedback loop. And this film, yeah, it very acutely and sort of amusingly pierces that in a very sort of experimental way, because the book is very experimental. The book is epistolary, but in a very curious kind of way that also includes within it the sort of actual book that he's written kind of thing. So, you know, it's very amusing, and they do find ways of sort of putting that on the screen as well. Jeffrey Wright is amazing in it. I mean, all of the performances are incredible, but Jeffrey Wright is just mesmerizing, and it's lovely to see him in the lead, because he's always just shown up in things and been my favorite thing in the thing he shows up in.
Yeah.
Like his little speech in Asteroid City is one of my highlights of Asteroid City, when he talks about his childhood. That was life. You know, when he plays the military guy.
Oh, the military guy. Yeah. Yes. Yes, he's really good.
It's so funny. And they just like keep moving the microphones as he tells each chapter. Yeah. Chapter 2.
Yeah, he's very good.
He's so funny. And yeah, it's also, it's just got the most wonderful portrayal of white people. Just whether sort of outwardly, actively, hostily, sort of anti-woke, or just supposedly harmlessly, you know, trying to be inclusive. It's just a wonderful expose of ignorance on all sides, and it's just lovely. There's a moment where the book he's written is sort of up for a prize that he is actually judging, but of course nobody knows that he is, because he's under a pseudonym. And so he's, you know, tried to convince his fellow judges not to give this ridiculous book the top prize that they're all trying to vote on. But they've basically ignored him and his fellow black judge. And in the end, you know, just sit down and say, you know, I'm glad that we're awarding this book. It's so important to listen to black voices, you know, instead of he's just there. It's a bit on the nose, maybe, but it's good fun. So I think for that, it is 4 stars. I really enjoyed the film.
Okay.
But it felt, I don't know, It feels very self-reflexive, and as much as it feels like it's anticipated the thing I'm criticizing it for.
Sure, fair enough.
But no.
Yeah, many layers.
Yeah, many layers. It's a complicated little thing. Mm. Whew. Okay. But what kind of stories can young black people tell about their experiences here in the UK?
Whatever they want, Paul. That's the point.
I'll tell you what. The kitchen.
The kitchen. There better be women.
There better be women. There's no women. So... not entirely fair, of course, as we've had some wonderful Black British films in the last few years particularly, but this is quite an exciting take on the urban decay crime drama.
Ooh, okay, yeah.
Might be as you'd expect, but perhaps not on this scale, because we are in the future, actually. It's a sci-fi movie.
Mm.
We have Kane Robinson as Izzy, who lives in a dystopian London housing estate, the last one, because social housing has been scrapped. So we just have this one left called The Kitchen. And the police regularly raid it, causing chaos for the locals because they're trying to drive people out in order to sell the space. Izzy is trying to get out through his day job at Life After Life, which is a funeral service that will turn your dead relatives into trees if you can't afford any kind of burial service.
Hmm.
But when he gets paired with a young boy who has lost his mother, he finds himself drawn back into the kitchen and its very fight for survival.
Was this at LFF?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I recognised the as soon as you said you met a young boy, I recognised it.
Yeah.
From that, I didn't see it, but I remember seeing the picture of it. I didn't realise it was set in the future.
It is. Yes, that was somewhat disguised because the sort of grim. I think basically what they did in order to potentially show how grim and depressing London social housing could get is they just went to Paris and filmed there.
Could be, yeah. There's some lovely bits of inner suburban, I think is the description, in suburbia.
They went to the same bits, I think, where they filmed Les Miserables, you know.
Some lovely city.
The Lajli film. Mm. There's so much going on here. So many experiences of poverty and class inequality and police prejudice in particular, just reducing the police to this faceless kind of other that comes in and sort of wreaks havoc. It's the directorial debut of Kibwe Tavare and actor Daniel Kaluuya. And what an assured debut this is from both of them. It looks gorgeous. The pacing is fabulous. It really pulls you along. The performances throughout are incredibly natural, including a surprise appearance from Ian Wright, the football commentator, who plays the sort of jockey of the kitchen, running a sort of pirate radio there that also serves as a warning system. And he's great. He's really affecting and quite heartbreaking in moments.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ian Wright.
Yeah. Very unexpected from old Wrighty.
Old Wrighty.
old lefty righty. Because the film absolutely is just on the right side of, you know, its political message here in terms of the situation people are put in, and the weird guilt that might be associated with aspirations to move out of such spaces. You know, are you a traitor because you want to get out of this place? It's, you know, a really fascinating movie about belonging and responsibility and that kind of lovely stuff. So I'm giving it 4 stars. I thought it was really quite impressive.
Cool. Nice.
Sounds good.
Good stuff.
At this stage, I don't have any notes at all for the last few. So I'm going to have to improvise the matchmaking.
That's fair enough.
You know when your most boring friend gets together with your other most boring friend and have boring family together?
That's happened so many times.
Let's say yes, that's what happens. The boy's in the boat. So this is a George Clooney biopic film about the 1936 Summer Olympics team, men's rowing. And oh God, I feel like I've just said it all, really. That's just exactly what it's about. Joel Edgerton is the sort of rowing coach who inspires a bunch of young kids, many of whom are starving. You know, they've lived through the Depression, and they just want a shot at getting some money, but then they actually find themselves surprisingly invested in the actual act of rowing. And so it's about their training, it's about the setbacks, it's about the class discrimination they experience. You know, because they're the poor kids and, you know, for the Olympics, they want to send the rich kids and the better colleges. It's just, it plays out exactly as you'd expect. Joel Edgerton's good. Everybody knows Joel Edgerton is good. And Callum Turner is quite good as the sort of head, you know, main kid who has anger issues, understandable anger issues at the injustices that he regularly has to face. It's a movie about discrimination and sort of underdogs. About a bunch of white kids, and there's a bit in the Olympics where they bump into Jesse Owens.
He's just there
like, oh, hey, how's your much more interesting story going on? Like, Clooney does a good job of sort of grounding the nostalgia and building up the pace and doing the race sequences in quite a tense way. And he does a relatively good job of demonstrating the stakes, you know, the idea that, you know, if we win, it'll be a thumb in the nose. I don't know how words work for Hitler, Olympics. They really want the Nazis to win. We don't want them to win, so this will be a good little humiliation for them. But it's so old-fashioned and it's so low stakes, and it just, I don't know, it just does not do the job of making you actually invest in this story, and you know exactly what's going to happen throughout. So yeah, it's a fairly dull film. I think it's just 2 stars, and that's relatively generous.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
It'll do. It's a dad movie, I think, for a sleepy, you know, bank holiday Monday afternoon.
Yeah.
You can drift in and out. You'll get what's going on.
Fair enough.
They're still rowing. Oh yeah.
Yeah, still rowing. Yeah. They won yet.
What happened to the
Not
sick?
Not quite.
What happened to
they
the?
Will.
What happened to the sick one? Oh, he's still sick. Oh well. He'll be all right for the end though.
Yeah. Love of his country will heal him.
Yes. It sure will. It healed me. Oh, so who's the other boring one at the dinner party? It's One Life.
One Life. Oh.
Yeah.
Anthony Hopkins.
And it's a bit of a shame because it's a fairly interesting story. It's another Holocaust story. You know, it's the story of Nicholas Winton, Sir Nicholas Winton, a British sort of humanitarian who rescued a lot of kids from the Holocaust. Via sort of child sort of transfer programs that he sort of ran. Mm-hmm. And it's simultaneously telling the story of him trying to figure out what to do with his briefcase. You know, because he wants to put it in some kind of museum or place somewhere. This is a briefcase that means a great deal for him. And it's then intercut with him as Johnny Flynn in the past. Johnny Flynn as him in the past, sort of telling the story of how he managed to do this. And it's all building up to the infamous sort of heavily viral recently sort of interview moment where he is confronted at a BBC television program. That's Life, I think. That's Life, where he's basically surprised with the fact that he's surrounded by the grown-up kids that he saved, you know, later on in his life. It's a very powerful clip. For that extraordinary sort of story, it's still a very generic kind of telling of that story. Very much like Boys on a Boat. They pair well together. Except that this is a much more interesting story, but ultimately the emotional context and heft is absolutely conveyed in that short clip of him at the actual That's Life screen sort of recording. You know, it doesn't really necessitate a two-hour backstory, which unfolds pretty much exactly as you'd expect. If there's things to commemorate, it is Anthony Hopkins as Sir Winton, because my God, he's always wonderful, but he affects such a sort of gentleness. The moment where he has to recreate, the moment where he discovers he's surrounded and he has to, you know, get a little handkerchief out and lightly dab his eyes, it just, he really perfects the mannerisms and really bespeaks a sort of, you know, very cuddly old man in a way that you maybe wouldn't have expected from old Hannibal Lecter, but it's good stuff. But yeah, I've given it 3 stars. It's got solid, more than Boys on the Boat. I'm grading on a curve here, so
fine.
It's better than Boys on the Boat, but most weeks it probably would have gotten the 2. It's vaguely annoying that they decided to take this on without having a clear idea of how to make it engaging or anything more than just a very standard British biopic.
Yeah, it's hard to do a biopic, isn't it? I think, because it involves real people.
What a wonderful segue into our next film.
I'm so glad to be helpful.
Bob Marley, One Love.
Okay. Oh, is that already out?
Yep, it's out. It's out, and it is the story of Bob Marley, pretty much from his attempted assassination through to his big performance of back in Jamaica, I think, his return to Jamaica after his sort of exile. You know, his appropriately named exile, because he made the album Exodus whilst he was kind of away, because after they tried to kill him, various gangsters in Jamaica, potentially because of his efforts to bring political leaders together, he then flees to sort of the UK, where he stays for a number of years before he returns. So it's Reynaldo Marcus Green's sort of film, starring Kingsley Ben-Adir, and I think Kingsley Ben-Adir is the sort of standout here, because he really is marvelous as Marley. He captures the energy, he captures the charisma, he captures the effortless sort of charm of the man, the just magnetic quality of just wanting to see him speak and wanting to hear his words. And for his part, like, a number of sort of, you know, Marley's teachings are in there, and he's, you know, talking about them, but it's very general.
Sure.
You know, it's very non-immediately political. It's just, you know, everyone should love each other and don't worry, things are going to be fine. And it kind of, it plays into the kind of stereotype of Marley, less as a revolutionary figure and more of a just sort of stereotypical hippie figure who advocated for marijuana and wanted everyone to just be happy all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't really get into the danger that he kind of, you know, the positive danger he represented to certain establishment types who are benefiting from the violence he fought against. I don't know. It's just, again, a very generic story. And more than anything else, it's a story about how fame can get to your head. And how you could lose track of your roots as a result of being separated from the people that made you. And it's like, really? That's the one you gravitated towards? That old chestnut in a character as interesting as Marley, where you could easily take on any number of potential issues with his legacy. Like the fact that, you know, how, morally, how is it to take a music that is a music of rebellion, struggle, of the expression of a sort of really oppressed class within Jamaica, and to take that and to merchandise it around the world, you know, and make it accessible and make yourself a sort of poster for reggae music, you know, when you're offering a fairly, like, there's loads of revolutionary stuff in his music, but to many it's Three Little Birds, you know, it's that's the sort of stuff that sticks. So why not engage with that? Well, potentially the fact that 3 of the people who produced this have the surname Marley might bespeak why this isn't quite the warts and all kind of movie that you might expect. It's also, you know, that Reynaldo Marcus Green, this is the director of King Richard, you know, the Will Smith kind of Williams sister's dad movie. So, you know, it's just, it's not revolutionary. It's not terribly exciting, and it doesn't do a very good job of sort of saying anything unique about a very singular talent. And potentially for me, I had this ruined a little further. Oh, Lashana Lynch is also excellent as Rita Marley, incidentally. Okay. She's really good. Lashana Lynch is always great. She was wonderful in... She's very good in... I'm only thinking of her blockbusters now. I'm trying to think of something a bit more. She was in Matilda the Musical. She was very good. She was very good in The Woman King. But of course she was in No Time to Die, where she, you know, made quite the impression. Yes. She's always excellent, but she's really she's really wonderful as Rita. The soundtrack is also incredible, of course. Lots of incredible music. Lots of just really wonderful music. And on my way home, I listened to Exodus, you know, because I just thought, I haven't listened to that in a while. So if it's a good chance to hear some Marley music on the big sound system, then that's good. But, oh, God, sometimes it's so on the nose. You know, oh, they're all having just a playful little session together. Let's play jamming, you know. And it's just, you know, and he's telling his kids not to worry. You know, and it's like, like, oh God, really? It gets a bit, it feels a little like Bohemian Rhapsody in some respects, except the big difference is that the big showstopper ending isn't there, because we get to the final concert and then we fade to the, you know, the cars, you know, Marley would die within just 3 years, you know, kind of thing. And it's, but the big issue for me is that I have read and really loved Marlon James' novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings, which is about the men who shot Marley, although not explicitly. He's always referred to as the singer, you know, in the book. And that is a very dark, upsetting, kind of oppressive novel about life in Jamaica at the time, and also about how basically the CIA did it, you know, about how, you know, American interference in every aspect of American political and social life was a massive thing that Bob Marley was kind of fighting against. In spite, and again, you can get into hypocrisy there, that, you know, that was essentially his market eventually. Yeah, but it paints a much more complex view of the figure and what he meant to the people of Jamaica as their sort of de facto representative overseas. You know, what does that mean? And yeah, it's just a really challenging, exciting, and brilliant work. And so, yeah, it makes it just all the more obvious how straightforward this is.
Yeah, fair enough.
So yeah, what did I give it? I give it 3 stars.
Okay, fair enough.
That's about right. Yeah, that'll do. Maybe it's 2, actually. It's a little annoying. It is a little frustrating that they didn't manage to make something a bit more provocative and interesting for Marley's life. Yeah, I call it 2.
Okay. That's allowed.
But sometimes, just sometimes, a movie perfectly is able to match its material and realize its full potential. It is, of course, The Beekeeper. Oh, God.
Okay, cool.
So I'll be brief, because we've done a podcast with Bex about this over at One Good Thing. But this is the new Jason Statham movie, directed by David Ayer, written by Kurt Vimmer. Two men with very interesting action movie careers. You can go and look into that. Kurt Vimmer, most famous for having directed Equilibrium. David Ayer. And David Ayer, most famous for having been involved in Training Day, but I also get which way round. He wrote Training Day. It was directed by... Antoine Fuqua. He also wrote The Fast and Furious, a little movie underseen these days.
Yeah, barely talked about.
He is back on form, though, because David Ayer was struggling for a bit. He made a bunch of fairly bad films, including Suicide Squad and Bright, and the somewhat derisive Fury. But he's back on form with The Beekeeper, because, you know, we've got Jason Statham. He plays Adam Clay, who is living a quiet life as a beekeeper, and he's living in the house of a retired school teacher named Aloise Parker, played by Felicia Rashad. One day, Aloise Parker is taken in by one of these awful scams that you see that sort of hijacks her computer and manages to steal all of her money, including $3 million that she just happened to have in a bank account waiting to give to a children's charity she manages. So she then kills herself, sending Jason Statham on a bloody rampage of revenge that's going to bring him into conflict with some very unlikely figures who turn out to be somewhat in charge of this illegal phishing scam. Somewhat related to, the sort of face of which is Josh Hutcherson as Derek Danforth. And it's wonderful seeing Josh Hutcherson play just a millennial and therefore an outright heinous villain. This is Jason Statham taking on the tech bros, and it's his John Wick movie, only he's got bees instead of a dog.
He's got bees and an old lady.
He's got bees and an old lady, and it's incredibly funny. The word bees is never not amusing when it's used in this, and it's used a lot because the idea is that he's not just a beekeeper, but beekeepers are a code word for a special kind of covert agent who are responsible for the well-being of the hive. And so there's a lot of very earnest talk about his function within society in the context of him being a beekeeper, but also in him being a bee. He's also that metaphor becomes very incoherent as time goes on, and he has a number of different roles within this particular hive. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous little film that is incredibly fun. It realizes the potential that so many of these movies do have, but very few actually live upon, which is to just realize how silly they are and to play it very straight, and just keep escalating. And it does so in quite a charming and relentlessly entertaining way. So, yeah, I think The Beekeeper is just absolutely perfect for what it is. I can't in all seriousness give it more than 3 stars, I don't think.
Oh, you can, Paul, if you want to.
I can't. It's 4 stars. It's not really striving for anything great, but it's achieving what it is striving for.
Yeah, and you had a fun time, right? You enjoyed it.
I had a tremendously fun time.
Then it's allowed to have 4 stars.
Okay.
Everything is classed within, you know, it's all being graded against its own criteria.
Exactly. That's what Roger Ebert would have done. And he would have loved The Beekeeper.
He would have.
Bon voyage, douchebag. Oh, God. All right. We're at the sort of end of the evening, and the only two people left who haven't gotten off of each other are the kind of awkward goth kids at the back of the room.
Okay.
And they're both into it, but they haven't made eye contact in a while. So let's see if we can nudge them into it, shall we? We've got the two horror movies of the past 6 weeks, starting with Night Swim.
Night Swim.
What happened there?
I paused because I was like, didn't we cover this? No, I listened to the One Good Thing episode.
Oh, yes.
That's why.
There was also a One Good Thing about this. This is the last one there was a One Good Thing about. I reviewed it with Katie Madon.
Yes, you did.
Yes, I did. Yes, this is Night Swim. This is from producers Jason Blum and James Wan, directed by Bryce McGuire, whose only previous credit was the sort of short film upon which this was based. It's about a family. They move into a new house and there's a haunted pool there. And you just want it to be as fun as that sounds. The pool summons up creepy people to sort of stare at you, and then if you're in the water, it might pull you underneath, and you know the weird ghosts will get you. That's kind of the way it works. However much I would love this to be a sort of deathbed style situation where the pool maybe melts you or sort of manifests like, yes, inexplicable star power in this. You've got Wyatt Russell, Kurt Russell's kid, who's slightly too intense. He's being possessed by the pool, essentially, so he has to play it quite intense. But there's just this ever so... He's wonderful at having this simmering rage just beneath the surface. He's got very Jack Nicholson vibes in everything I see him in, where you just feel like, oh, it wouldn't take much to get this guy to really get properly angry with you.
Yeah.
And Kerry Condon, beloved Kerry Condon from the Banshees of Inisherin, is here as the wife. And it's just, somewhat inexplicable. And then playing the kids, actually, very good performers. I think Amelie Hofferl is relatively new, and Gavin Warren, they avail themselves very well. But I think I enjoyed the film at its most when it was sort of about the family, and there was the sense that the family are going to have to get together to take this thing on themselves, but then very quickly it becomes about the set pieces. And the set pieces are incredibly repetitive and are basically just reruns of the short film, which I actually find to be quite anticlimactic. I don't think the short film resolves itself in a very fun way for having quite a good premise and some good atmosphere and a very professional looking, you know, aesthetic.
Sure.
But you do get the impression that this is a bit of an industry insider directing this. I know he shot it in the short film he shot in the pool of a singer that Katie recognized. But so there is very much a sense of, okay, this is someone who's in with the inset in LA. And I don't know, it just doesn't excite me as much as it could. So it's fine. It's less than fine. I'm going to give it 2 stars. It didn't Fair actively enough. Irritate me, but it's very underwhelming.
Marco.
Well, quite. Should have been called Marco Polo.
Polo.
Should have been called Marco Polo. But speaking of, you know, short films that maybe didn't quite have the energy to be adapted into a full-length thing, we have got Baghead.
Not even heard of this one.
No, it's a very, very sort of quick-release horror movie directed by Alberto Corridor, mm-hmm. It looks like Corridor. Hang on a minute, written by Bryce McGuire. Is that not the guy I just said for Night Swim?
He's been busy.
Yes, he wrote the screenplay for this as well. Okay, fine. Not ideal for Bryce McGuire. Nevertheless, yes, this is a film about a young woman played by Freya Allen who, yeah, she inherits her father's pub. Her father is Peter Mullen, who has killed himself in said pub. And has now left it to her. She soon discovers that the pub has a very dark secret, which is that there is a woman chained in the basement who is capable, if she is given a item belonging to someone recently deceased, she kind of swallows it and is able to summon them for a minute. However, once that minute, I think it's a minute, once the very short time elapses, you are no longer speaking to the loved one, but you're speaking to her, but, you know, through the voice and face of the loved one.
Sure.
So it kind of, you know, corrupts. So, ostensibly, I guess this should be a film about longing and about being unable to move on. But instead, it kind of just does that thing that short films do when they sort of adapt a big screen, which is that they sort of, you know, the original film, I remember seeing at Fright Fest, it has this, it's a short little thing, it has a little twist, it's quite funny, it's, you know, scandalous, you know, scandalous kind of black humor kind of thing, and then it ends and you think, that was good, that was a good idea.
Yeah. Making some ideas only have about 20 minutes of runtime.
Oh god, this was like five. This was a very short film.
Sure, good.
And it worked. It worked in that context. You know, here you've got to heap on the lore. There's endless research sequences, expository sequences, which you had in The Night Swim as well. And it's just like, this is so much less scary for having explained it. And ironically, like, Katie and I did this as a double bill. We immediately moved on to All of Us Strangers, and that's how you tell a ghost story.
Okay.
You know, that's reviewed in our LFF episode. That's how you tell a story about longing and darkness and the sort of, you know, the pain of having to try and move on and the sort of catharsis that might be realized by having experiences with the other side, which may then turn out to be not as healthy as you thought. And it's a much more effectively scary film as well, actually, All of Us Strangers. Yeah, this film is just cliches heaped on top of each other with a vaguely original premise tying them together. So, yeah, it's one star for Baghead, I'm afraid.
Wow.
It's very forgettable.
Okay.
Whew. And that's it. All the couples are gone. It's just you and me to close up this, what was it? A barn?
Yep. And you're chained in it. And I'm going to feed you this packet of crisps.
Ooh, okay. This is better than what I would have managed not chained up.
Yeah, you're lucky. You should be grateful.
I surrender the last of my willpower.
Good.
Yay.
My plan is working. This is the part of the episode where I tell you about a film I watched.
Oh,
in
yes,
the past
please.
Month.
We should do this last. We should do it up front.
No, we shouldn't.
We should.
Because I never prepare anything. I watched Worst Person in the World.
Oh, yes, so you did. Yes,
reviewed so I did.
In Jen and the Film Critic number. Imagine if I was able to remember the number.
Imagine.
Wouldn't that be incredible?
Imagine.
Tell you what, I'll find out, though, whilst you're banging on.
Well, I liked it. That was essentially all I was going to say. It's a good film. Paul has reviewed it, which is why I'm mentioning it. I'm not going to say if I watched Jurassic Park, I'm going to mention the films that have come up already or are good. Yeah, we've got a Mubi subscription at the moment.
Ooh.
So chance to watch some actual films.
I hear those guys are top blokes.
Yes. yeah, we watched it and it was good and I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's funny. I'm not sure if I had mixed it with another film or like essentially the title is perhaps a little misleading if you don't know anything else about the film.
Sure.
But I liked the title. Once you've watched it, you're like, oh, it's a good title and I can see what you're doing with that.
Yeah, it's all about her sort of self-doubt and sort of perception of herself.
Exactly. But I thought it was going to be a lot more sort of like edgy, dark humor throughout. There is, it is funny in places, but I wouldn't call it a comedy.
Yeah. Oh, wow. We reviewed The Worst Person in the World in Jen and the Film Critic 4.
No.
Yeah. And we had, well, then. We discussed 7 films.
Yeah, Paul, remember when it was good?
Remember when you were then? More available to do this more often?
Remember when you could restrain yourself?
I've been going to the cinema too much.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Go watch films, everyone. Go see something.
Go watch some films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Worst Person in the World. Enjoyed it.
Love it.
Relatable. Enjoyable. Nice. I had a nice time.
Renée
Zellweger? Yes.
Renée Zellweger. I'm trying to have a freestyle go at her name. I'm going to check how
did
close
she win
I got.
A Cannes Award for the Best Actor?
Renata Rensver.
Ah.
There we go.
Yeah, she was very good. I really loved the main Renata.
She did. She won Best Actress.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. She deserved it. Very good.
Yeah.
I don't know who she was up against, but she did a good job.
Oh, that's a good point.
She deserved it.
Let me just quickly find out if I agree with that or if I massively disagree. Oh god, that would involve finding out who else was at the.
Yeah.
I've already lost so much interest in this, Jen. Jen, help me. Annette was there, so maybe it should have gone to the little puppet girl. Compartment number 6 was there.
Oh, I liked that.
Yeah, it was good.
Did I see that? Wait, the train one. Yeah.
Yeah, the train one. The one I had shingles for.
The one you had shingles for.
One of the many ones I had shingles in. Yeah. Oh, the French Dispatch was there that year. Memoria. There's always a chance to just give it to... you could have given it to... What's her name? The best woman ever. What's her name? Tilda Swinton.
Oh.
So those.
I'm giving it to Renata.
Tilda Swinton?
Renata.
Tilda Swinton?
Renata.
Donata.
Paul, who has the bag of crisps?
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
All that, thank all you. That willpower and such. Ah, Donata. Renata. Donata.
Renata. Donata.
Jen, how can people find out about other things that we do?
Well, gosh, do we have? Yeah, we do other things.
We do some other things too.
We do other things.
It's not all this.
It's not all this. It seems like it is because we're so professional about it.
Uh-huh.
And everything's so carefully scripted, but it's not all this. Paul and I also do an actual play podcast, which is
a
type of podcast where you take one of those nerdy games like Dungeons and Dragons and you play it with your friends and you record the game.
Cool.
And we that podcast called Quest Fantastic, the first season was indeed Dungeons and Dragons big nerd game, and second season will be starting soon, and that is of a game called Orbital Blues, and it's about space cowboys. It's very cool. So go check out Quest Fantastic. You also do cool film podcasts, One Good Thing.
I do OGT Pod.
OGT Pod.
OGT Pod.
Everything.
Type that
everything
in.
At OGT Pod.
Yep. And you'll find
Stalwart.
Out about the OGT. It is Stalwart, but might be shaken up in the not too distant future. I say that. Ooh. December, January next year. So until then.
No, that's pretty distant.
Fairly distant future. So
yeah, fairly distant.
Yeah. Until then,
a mere year
we're just going to be doing Adam Sandler flicks.
Yeah, great. And I love it because it makes me happy when you're sad.
Yay. She sure is happy a lot.
I really am. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at filmcriticpodcast@gmail.com. Our theme music was by Jacob Blundell.
Woo!
And you can get in touch with us on the social media at Screen Mayhem, for this is a Screen Mayhem podcast.
For it is.
My name is Jen Blundell. And Paul Salt is my film critic. So goodbye, film critic.
Goodbye.
Volovant.
Voulez-vous
coucher avec moi?
Villeneuve.
Ce soir.